Everlast gained fame as the lead vocalist of the Irish-influenced hip-hop group House of Pain in the early 90s with their infectious hit, Jump Around. But by 1998, House of Pain had disbanded, and Everlast, now nearly 30, took on a new persona for his solo career, Whitey Ford. His first hit single, What It's Like, was more than just a musical departure from the up-tempo rock rap anthems of his youth. It was a lesson in empathy. Dr. Natalie Petohoff believes business leaders often don't know what it's like for employees and customers to experience their brand. She co-authored Empathy in Action with Tony Bates, a book that teaches how empathy-based business criteria can transform customer and employee experiences, galvanize trust and loyalty, and drive better business results. This week on Next in Q, we discuss the biggest misconception about empathy, what customers really want, how empathy transforms business practices, the two most critical missing measures on the P&L statement, how the pandemic changed the workforce forever, how emotional connections affect brand service recovery efforts, the economics of customer and employee experience, the surprising relationship between empathy and efficiency, and how generational differences impact the workforce zeitgeist. Let's get to it.
Welcome to Next in Q, the podcast for contact center and customer experience professionals. Next in Q is brought to you by Happy 2 Vision. Eliminate blind spots and see right through every conversation with Happy 2 Vision. Learn more at happitu.com. Now, here's your host, Rob Dwyer.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for joining yet another episode of Next in Q. My name is Rob Dwyer, and today we're talking with Dr. Natalie. Dr. Natalie, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you for asking.
You are an author of many books. You've been in the contact center business for a long time on the technology side. You've been an analyst. Some might say you kind of know what you're talking about, but I want to talk about your most recent book and kind of what you're doing with that. So your most recent book that you co-wrote with Tony Bates, Empathy in Action. I talked to a fair number of authors, but what I really love is that you are actually putting this into action. I mean, it's literally in the name, but we're going to talk about that. But I want to know, what misconceptions do people have when they hear the word empathy?
Do you have about 6 hours?
I don't know that we've got quite that long, but let's just see how you can get through the big one or two.
So I think the biggest confusion is that sympathy and empathy are the same. Sympathy is a statement, natural human response to someone expressing a situation, a problem, a challenge, and it's in our nature And what we found, it's global, it's not a North American thing, that we want to respond, right? And we respond out of compassion. But what's really interesting in the customers that we've been interviewing is that while they thought they appreciated sympathy, at the end of the day, what they really want is empathy. And empathy in this particular definition means that either from the chat or the phone call or the SMS or however I as a customer am reaching out to you, said company, that you will understand that my house is on fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that I don't want to hear, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry to hear that that's happening to you. That must be a very frustrating situation, Natalie. And Natalie, as the person here that is designated to help you, I'm going to get right on this. And I remember when my family had a fire, they lost all their pictures. I can completely get how frustrating this is. Let me look into this, right? And that, so if you go back to the beginning of time in contact center world, and you see that we started 1950s, 60s, depending on where you start, and even sales contact centers or sales outward bound marketing started earlier, right? What you find is when people have a situation, they want it fixed. And so in interviewing customers and even interviewing agents, what we found was the customers really don't want to hear that script, right? And that's, we have, and I'm collective we, right? Because I've been part of the industry. We have scripted agents to say sympathy statements.
Mm.
What customers really want, if they said their house is on fire, is to hear, I'll get the hose. They yeah. want to hear, not only did I hear what you were saying, but I'm actively listening. I've cognated the situation. I don't need to tell you all that sympathy stuff because what you want from me right now is help. And my job is to get the hose. And so what we found was that distinction in determining if you are able to distill that down and respond like that, that's what customers are really looking for. So I know this is going to set a lot of people back, right? Because the whole idea of scripting to create consistency, and especially if you use a business process outsourcer, right? How do you get consistency among thousands of agents, right? But what we've found is that what customers really want is they just want you to help them. And all yeah. that, say customer's name three times and all those things actually make a lot of customers really mad and more grumpy because what they're thinking is, I pressed the right IVR buttons, I answered your freaking chat questions, and you still don't get it. So now I'm grumpy and angry and I'm going to be rude, right?
Yeah.
So what that ends up doing to the agent, right, is makes their job unbearable.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder why agent attrition and retention are so difficult. Well, who would want to be yelled at all day long by angry customers? So kind of what I did when I sat down to really look at if I could make a contribution and leave a legacy, how could I look at the way that we've been doing things and really turn it on its head, see it for what it really is, step outside of the box, try for myself and for the industry to remove blind spots and really see what is it that we're trying to do in this interaction. And that's really been my goal and my exploration.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So the inaction part of both the title and actually what you're working on right now, let's talk about that. You're working with DoorDash and their contact center. What are the things that you're actually implementing to change how the customer experiences when they call in and they need help?
So I think the first thing with all my clients is to be able to look at what are the paradigms and what are the blind spots, right? So how are we approaching that experience? So have we actually sat down and mapped the customer journey? Have we mapped the employee experience? And have we mapped the corresponding technology that delivers that customer experience and enables the employee to be able to help that customer? So I would say 9 times out of 10, while we may have done some mapping, the mapping is usually done to create an ROI model for the vendor and some feel good about maybe the customer. And what I've seen in particular is that rarely do executives sit in the seat of the customer or the employee and feel and see the experience from their point of view, not from some business case that says, if we take our phone calls and we transfer them to chat, what's the ROI, right? So that happens all the time, right? And I was in a just on a LinkedIn discussion the other day about, a company that wanted to do this but hadn't sat in the seat of the customer. And it's not a bad thing, right? I personally don't think we'll ever get rid of phone calls, but that's my 3 cents. But when you do create that experience, how are you really determining that that's the right choice? And then have you actually examined what that experience will be like? And so a lot of technology, in my experience, has been proposed, sold, and implemented without actually sitting in the seat of the person receiving the experience or the person given the experience. And so a lot of my work ends up being sitting in the contact center, sitting, doing what I would call side by side with a headset on or watching the chat and listening to what the customer says, seeing what how the employee is responding, and then determining is that the on-brand experience that we want for this company. And I really wish that I could take every CEO of every company and the CFO and the COO to their contact center and have them have that experience. Now, one trick that I've done before, which has been very effective, is to record a call or a number of calls and play them in a meeting. It's just say, here's something we wanted you to listen to. They listen to it and they're like, wow, that's horrible. I'm like, yeah, isn't it? Like, what do you think about that? And then they're like, well, I'm glad we don't do that. And I'm like, well, actually, this is recording.
Actually,
Actually, I hate to break it to you, but this is actually from your contact center. And then there's like, well, this must be a one-off, right? This can't be like, and I'm like, let me show you 500 more instances of those. And so I think that what there's Forrester, Bain, a lot of really great research companies have done a study. And the study asked executives for you, I think Forrester did this 15, 20 years ago. Bain, I think, recently repeated it. And they asked executives at companies, how do you think you do with customer employee experience? And 80% will say, we're fantastic. It's in our 10K. It's one of our goals on the plaque on in our hallways. Sometimes it ends up being a platitude on a plaque. It's really important to us, right? And our customers mean everything, and so do our employees. And yet, they rarely listened or heard or experienced that. And so I think that then when you go and you do the same study and you ask employees and customers, what was your experience? They'll say 80% of companies don't get it. Now, how can there be? That's not like a little tiny 49-51. That's 20-80, right?
Yeah.
That's in the world of having been
Polar opposite.
right. That the data says, and it's interesting that the data was measured over, different groups, different industries, different research firms. Got the same results in a different time span. So fascinating to me, right? Because I used to be a scientist, so I love data. And so what's fascinating to me in the time and space that I've been in this industry is we still have a gap.
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of my job is to get executives to sit down and understand what that experience is. Now, the other thing, Rob, that I think is fascinating is that every single one of us is a customer.
Yeah,
at some point.
Absolutely.
Unless you never order anything, right, online or call. But I think everybody has that experience. What happens is this corporate amnesia where we forget as executives what that experience feels like. And we're thinking in our head, what is that company thinking? Right. But then when we go back into our corporate role and we begin to make choices and decisions, we have this corporate amnesia about, or maybe a blind spot, that it's actually possible that our experience could be that bad. And so I really want to encourage everyone that's listening to go to a contact center that you either own or you're working with and listen to the calls and get the feedback and do focus groups with your agents and talk to them. And I mean, one of the things that Amazon did, which was really amazing very early on when they were beginning the website, was to create customer advocacy groups. And those customer advocacy groups were designed to give the company feedback so that they could get better and better and better and better. And truthfully, the title of the book, Empathy, so we kind of go back to what are the misconceptions about empathy. In my very early days as an engineer, I worked for a large automotive company. And this was before my time because this was in the 50s and 60s. But there was a man named Edward Deming, and he was kind of a quality guy. And his whole premise was, if you listen to the voice of the customer and the voice of the employee, there's so much rich data, so much rich information, right? That data is like the canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. If you understand it, if you actually take it seriously, if you begin to implement that feedback into your business, it's going to make all the difference in the world. And the title of this book is basically based on the work that I studied back when I worked in the automotive company. Empathy is the ability to sit in the seat of the customer and the employee, understand from their point of view what that means, and then in action means take action based on the other person's point of view. Very, yeah. Very powerful when you do this. And what Deming did was he tried to approach the big three, and they all said, nah, we got this, we know, right? And that was a major blind spot for them. He went to Japan and he completely transformed the Japanese auto market.
Mm.
So that's what I really mean.
Yeah.
Is that ability to really sit in the seat of the other and transform. And when you do that, oh my God, bro, like what I found is that people are like, oh, we should fix this. And we should, it would be like, they get excited again. They're like, this would be so cool if we could do this and this and this. And so I want people to not see it as, I'm not talking about creating kumbaya factories. I'm not asking you to spend more. I'm asking you to think differently and to spend differently in ways that are going to make the difference to the two most important assets that you have in a company, customers and employees, neither of which, fascinating for me, are on the P&L.
Yeah, that's right. They're not. You know, I wonder how quickly things would change if executives, senior executives, CEOs actually sat down for a day and took phone calls and took chats. Like, it's one thing to sit side by side, and you and I have both done this and we get it. But if you've never actually taken a phone call and had to navigate the systems and do all the things that agents do every day for 8 or more hours a day, it can be really hard to understand the challenges that they're going through. And it's not just the one call. Like, sit there and take calls when you're in queue and you've got people waiting for 3 minutes or more before they get to talk to someone, and then begin that conversation after they've tried to use your chatbot and they've been on your website and they can't find the answer and they've tried these digital channels that you've maybe implemented and they're upset. And then, right, then once you have that empathy for what your agents are doing every day, you can understand too what the customer is going through when they come in and they're not getting answers very quickly or they're not getting the answers that they want. And it can help you then make changes to empower your agents, to provide them a better experience so that they're improving your customer experience. And those two that are not on the P&L come together to make your P&L better.
That's my bottom line. I mean, so a couple points there. One is, yes, the job of an agent is very complicated. So there's a lot of technology, right? So it's mostly a computer screen, right? And so the call or the chat through telephony is populated, right? They get a screen pop and you get the chat or you get the phone call, and then you have to actively listen. And then if there's a script, then, you know, you have your whole scripting thing. And there's oftentimes 20 or 30 windows open, and there's a knowledge base and there's a process thing that you have to check. And then you have to check this, you know, during work call, check this box, do this, do that, right? And I'm always amazed at how they know, what did you just do? Could you show me that again? And so I don't think that executives understand that job, right? And I think the whole theory of management by walking around needs to be instituted. You know, Herb Keller did a really good job when he was the CEO of Southwest Airlines. But I also think that actually sitting in the seat, being empathetic, so not just like walking around and showing your face and talking and kind of getting the vibe of what people are saying, but actually do the job of the person. And when you do the job of the person, you have a visceral understanding that you cannot have. Even watching,
yeah,
is different. When it reminds me of waiters who can carry like 10 trays and not spill anything. It's like, how do you balance all that? Like, I don't think I could do that job well, right? And it would take me a while. And yeah, I get now, you know, like having seen this for 20 years, why it takes time to train people, right? It's not just policies and the script. But like, how do you go from this to this to this to this and after call work wrap ups and all the things? And so I'm really looking at changing the economic model. And part of what I'm writing about these days is, so you have two assets, you have employees and customers. Without employees, there's no one to create products and services for your customers. And without customers, there's no one to buy them. And yet, their value, employee lifetime value, customer lifetime value, does not exist in the P&L. Sales indirectly is a measure. Attrition sometimes is measured, or the cost of hiring. But that direct connection of what is the customer and what is the employee experience, and how does that those metrics connect to an actual measurement? So if we take average handle time or first contact resolution or CSAT, how do we take that metric and relate it to something that someone at the C-suite level or the board level cares about? Because I think Natalie's view on the economic model and the frustration and the recession, part of it is, there's many factors, right? But one of it is, if you provide an amazing place to work, where people feel acknowledged and seen and heard, that you've figured out the balance of remote work versus not, like, you know, if you're an automotive manufacturer, you have to be in the plant to make the, like, we haven't figured that out from home. Not yet. But what, you know, like, how do you create a culture so compelling that you're the magnet, that you're the employer of choice, that everybody's banging on your door to get in, right? Now you have the choice of top talent, you have innovation, you have productivity, you have motivation, right? And all these conversations about, you know, quiet quitting don't become part of your employee zeitgeist, mm-hmm. right? So there's the employee economic model. And how many companies are really looking at their own culture and how it is to be part of that culture? And I think quiet quitting is a silent retaliation. It's quiet retaliation for all the crappy cultures over the last, I don't know, 100 plus years, right? Go back to the first industrial revolution and, you know, people couldn't go to the bathroom. Machinery is dangerous in a factory. There was child labor. So while you see progress and you see progress equal to the consciousness of where we are today, in today's world, I believe that the pandemic gave us a cause for pause. And in that cause for pause, what it did was it really transformed people's mindset about what's important to them, what's value to them, and what they really want for their life. And when we came back to normal, right, which is there's no normal, but when we came back to a reassemblance of the world, what I think a lot of CEOs don't realize is it's a different workforce. It's a workforce that has been transformed forever. It was a workforce that was overstressed, overworked, overtired, and frustrated, had a moment, this cause for pause, did a lot of self-reflection, and they're like, you know what, I'm not going to put up with this. So if I'm at your company and it's a bad culture, I'm just going to, like, do my minimum, right, and look for something else until I can find a better one. And there's a lot of people that you see a lot of the studies, they stay because there's not great other choices. And so I think that CEOs who are, like, grappling with this, what if you took a look at your culture? What if you really took a look at really truly becoming that employer of choice? So there's that economic model, right, of changing culture so that you become the employer of choice and you have the productivity and innovation and motivation. Then what if you created products and services that were so compelling that customers were banging down your door to get them? How do you do that, right? Is it guesswork? Do you sit in a room by yourself or with a bunch of other smart people and create this stuff? If you're really listening, if you have your ear to the ground and you really understand what people want and need, which comes from talking to people, talking to customers, understanding what the gaps are, looking in social or digital media, because a lot of times people talk about things that they wish would be, there's so much rich research data there that you could begin to create a company that is so focused on customer-centric products and services. You wouldn't have a problem with sales because instead of having to sell, you would be order taking. You couldn't take the orders fast enough. And then to keep those customers, to keep that customer lifetime value coming, right? Because it's one, it's great to have someone purchase once, but what you want in customer lifetime value, that equation looks like this. I want you to purchase at least once, and then I want you to purchase again. And each time you purchase, I want you to purchase more and more and larger amount. And I want you to do this for the lifetime of our relationship, right? And we want that to you pass, right? Or whatever that extension of that time frame is. So I think what's fascinating to me is we look at our frustrations, we look at the economic conditions, and I don't know that we're really looking at solving root cause. And I really, truly believe that customer and employee experience is one of those things that is underrated, undervalued, and if properly examined, it would transform companies and very quickly.
I mean, you touched on so many things there. I think one of the things that business leaders are forgetting or ignoring right now, aside from just the fact that the workforce has changed, and I agree with you, right? I mean, we all went through a pretty traumatic event, but also an event that made us, number one, depending on the work we do, we may realize, oh, I can be just as productive working at home, right? There's that. But we're also seeing the largest generation hit retirement age. And the workforce, the available workforce, is actually shrinking. And we haven't seen that in a long time. And so you see these incredibly low unemployment numbers and people go, well, you know what? I can find something better. I don't need to stick around. And so it's not just the pandemic. Yeah, that absolutely was a factor. But as you mentioned, there are a lot of things happening, a lot of things at play. And employees now are realizing, I think, more and more that what they may not be in the driver's seat, but they're also not at the back of the bus anymore. They are moving up. So there's that part, right? And making a great experience for your employees, that is something that will pay dividends, if for no other reason than it just eliminates your attrition. Maybe not eliminate, but right, slows it down. The other thing that you touched on,
right? There's always some natural attrition.
Mm-hmm.
There's some attrition that you want because it's not the right fit or not the sure. right culture. But it's sad when you see your very best employees opting out.
Yeah.
And that's, you don't want that.
No, absolutely not. The other thing that, you know, I just had Ron Holt from Pink Zebra Moving on the show, and we were talking about kind of delivering that experience. And I can think of other brands, and part of it is when you build that emotional connection with your customers, even if your products and services hit a road bump, if you've spent enough time developing that emotional connection with a customer, they forgive things. They're invested emotionally. And I will tell you, you know, I switched over to T-Mobile years ago. I think it was like 2013, right? And T-Mobile was an up-and-coming brand. They were doing things totally different. They were really trying to disrupt the marketplace. I'm still with them. Is their service the same as it was before? No, it's not. And T-Mobile, if you're listening, you can do better. But I've had this emotional investment for a decade, and it's going to take a lot to push me over the edge to where I'm going to say, you know what, I want to go somewhere else. They've invested and got that customer lifetime value with me, and I've got this emotional connection. And it would be different if it was year one and I was like, this isn't all it's cracked up to be. It's much easier for me to leave. Year 10, all of a sudden, it's a lot harder for me to do that because of that connection that I've developed. And so if brands focused on building that connection more, I think to your point, right, it's going to cause the customer attrition to reduce as well. And that's so much easier to maintain than that constant new customer growth.
And what's fascinating, another piece to the economic model here, is that we spend as companies a lot of money on customer acquisition, right? And so marketing, advertising, whoever's in charge of that budget They spend a lot of money there. And then what I traditionally see in my consulting world is that customer experience, quality assurance, whatever it's called, contact center, is constantly being asked to reduce their costs.
Right.
We have spend a lot of money and go get all these customers, right? Only to give them such a bad experience that they're so frustrated that they can't wait to leave and to trash your name and do, you know, horrible word of mouth marketing. So whenever I'm in these companies, I'm working with them, I'm like, could we look at the cost from customer acquisition? Oh, well, we don't have those numbers and that's not our stuff. To me, if I was a CEO or COO or CFO, I would be requesting, what is our cost of customer acquisition? How much are we spending on that? And then what is our customer attrition? And do we know why they're leaving, right? And how can we make this a better balance? And what if we change the customer experience? How does that change the customer lifetime value? Just like you said, and fascinating, but I mean, you have you're a data point, right? But your data point has been validated time after time by many researchers that when a customer has brand affinity and trust and loyalty, and that comes from having good experiences with the product as well as with service, that when there is a bump in the road, that customer is more likely to stay and by a very large percent. So it goes back to things to me that I'm like, how, Rob, how can we not have gotten this right? All the years that we have been doing this, how can this still be in 2023? How can this be a question? How can we not understand the implications of bad experiences? And this is not a nice to have. This is not kumbaya factories. This is not being nice to your customers. This is not sympathy. I'm talking about the economics of running a successful business.
Mm-hmm. So you touched on some things, and I just want to have you reinforce this. Some people might say, because they're not hearing really what you're saying, they're hearing the words, they might say, you know what, empathy, that's great and all, but efficiency, like they go like this. How do you respond to that?
So there's two kinds of efficiency and effectiveness. There's the efficiency and effectiveness that you get when you are looking at a situation from a business perspective. And so is it more efficient or effective to deliver, let's say we're going to transfer our phone calls from phone to chat, right? And there's an ROI calculation. And from the business's point of view, that is a good decision. Business-centric efficiency, business-centric effectiveness. Now, the model, the economic model that I'm talking about requires, did I say require?
You should say it one more time, I think.
Okay, requires that one sit in the seat of the person receiving the experience to determine efficiency and effectiveness from their point of view.
Yeah. So
let's say that I'm in an IVR. Press 1-4, press 2-4, press 64-4. Right? On paper, an IVR can be very effective and efficient. In the experience of implementing technology and the deliverance of a experience, from the customer's point of view, did it hit the customer's expectations? Do we ever test that? When you offer there have been companies that have just cut off phone and said, no, we're going to go to email or chat, right? Did you design that experience so amazingly, right? So on paper, oh my gosh, I got a raise, I got a bonus, I've been promoted because I cut all this money out of the budget. Great. Now, how many customers did you push away with a bad experience? Is that experience, was it designed, right, tested, implemented, and retested by using customer and employee feedback?
Yeah.
I can tell you that there are probably 2% of the companies on the planet that even look at this, because Rob, we're in a mindset of that the company knows best, right? And what's fascinating is that we've been in this mindset, zeitgeist, paradigm for so long that we don't think about, we need to do this customer journey mapping. We need to feel and sit in the seat of that customer and understand, what did we just do? And I'll tell you a short story from when I was working in the auto industry. I was working as an engineer, and they came to me and they said, you do corrosion testing. We're looking at one-sided versus two-sided galvanizing. We'd like to know your opinion. I'm like, okay, well, I can pretty much tell you, but because there was a reason why we went to two-sided, but I'll do the experiment. I do the experiment. I come back with the data. I said, here's how quickly the car doors will corrode. They go, okay, great. They get up with all their books and they're leaving the room. And I'm like, hey, just kind of curious, right? Very early on in my career, I still truly care, but like very impressionable care, right? I said, hey, what direction are you leaning? And they go, oh, one-sided. I was like, really? You know that that's going to create a lot of cars. And at the time I was living in Detroit, so in the winter, there's a lot of salt and ice, a lot of corrosion. I said, you know, that's going to mean a lot of car doors with holes in the side. And they go, mm-hmm. And I said, I don't understand why you're not worried about that. And their response back to me was, why are you so worried about that? You're an engineer. And I was just, like, I'm not often left for not having words, but I was just like, what just happened? And I think that impression of a business-centric decision, and maybe plan obsolescence, and I understand the whole argument, right, about wanting to be able to get customers to buy more, right? But if we look at the loyalty that the Japanese market created, there was a different way to go about that kind of repeat business. And I think that, you know, in this new world where customers and employees have so many choices, they have so many places to check the things that they want to buy, so many ways to get word of mouth, review sites, and we have sites, you know, for employers, you know, that I think it's a different world. There's much more transparency than there's ever been. And so hiding behind a blind spot of not really looking at what's really best for the two most important assets, to me, if I was a board of directors and I was hiring a CEO or CFO or executives, if they didn't have this mindset, I would not hire them.
Yeah. Natalie, you just said something that made me think about the fact that employees want to be proud of where they work and the products or services or both that they're delivering. And I have to imagine, right, you at this unnamed Detroit automobile manufacturer wanted to be really proud of the products that you were putting out. And in that moment, like, you really cared about the quality. And I think when businesses don't foster that culture, that attitude of pride in what they're doing, that's where you end up in the situation where all of a sudden we're okay with cutting corners and we're okay with really just focusing on this quarter, and somebody else can worry about next quarter. And we're okay with some of these lousy experiences as long as we hit the numbers. And if more companies focused on just creating that culture of everybody's proud to work here. And you talked about it earlier, right? Like, people really want to do a great job. If we foster that, everybody will be better off.
I couldn't have said it better, Rob. I think that, so if you look at quiet quitting, well, you look at the Great Resignation, which was the people are like, I'm just out of here. Then there was people quit, and then they kind of was like, oops, maybe I shouldn't have quit. So then you had the quiet quitting, which is I'll stay because I need an income. But because what you've taught me about our company culture is that it's okay to cut corners with our customers. So in my mind, right, as the employee, I'm like, well, maybe it's okay if I, as the employee, cut corners on what I do for you. And so I don't think quiet quitting is new. In fact, I could tell you stories of people running their own businesses from many of the companies that I've worked for, right? Xeroxing, using supplies, taking very long launches to go meet, right? Just a lot of stuff that's happened. I don't think it's new. I think the generation that is the younger generation is just a lot more vocal about saying what they feel. Whereas I think other older generations, they felt it. They felt that visceral kind of like, wow, all right. But they sucked it up and they just said, all right, you know, that I don't really like that. It doesn't really sit well with me. But, you know, I mean, my dad worked for Ford Motor Company for 45 years. And that's just what you did. You went to a company, you stayed, and you were loyal, regardless of whether you felt really proud or whether there were corners cut, right? And I'm not saying Ford did, but I'm just saying that that was the zeitgeist. And the zeitgeist now is I can find another job and this culture is kind of yucky, or we really don't care about our customers and that doesn't sit with what I'm about, then I'm going to quiet quit or I'm going to go look for something else. And so I think it's new to CEOs, right? Because I keep seeing Fortune and Forbes and all these companies reporting on this. I think it's new to CEOs. I don't think it's new to culture.
Do you think social media has an impact there? Couple of ways, right? It was easier to share our experiences with a wider swath of people, potentially millions. And you've got a generation that has grown up really just kind of sharing their life out in the open on social media. So when you say, right, that this younger generation is more open about or vocal about, you know, how they're feeling, I wonder if part of it is like, that's just how they grew up. Like, they shared everything.
I think that digital media has given us a level of transparency that we've never had before, right? So the canary in the coal mine, before, you know, you might hear people complaining and there would be word of mouth and that could be detrimental. But when you see someone post, an influencer post, or even, you know, you go on a review site and I make decisions based on what I read from people that I don't even know. I have no idea, right? Who they are, even like me. I read their review and I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't like that either, right? So I think that the level of, and I remember reading, and it's a great book if anyone's listening, you haven't read it, The Clue Train Manifesto. And those guys predicted there would be a point in time, and this was before the internet really blew up, that there would be a point in time, there would be a technology that would transform our lives in ways that we could not have imagined, because it would create a level of transparency, authenticity, and genuineness that is often hidden. Not that we didn't feel it, we felt it, but there wasn't a wide world web in which for it to be delivered.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the internet and networking sites, and then you had the evolution of digital media and social media, and now there's nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
Right. And I think I was watching a movie about the 60s, and it was about the hippies, and it was really fascinating because to me, in the 1960s, 70s, what it reminded me of is the very young folks now, they're the new hippies. And the hippies were saying, we don't like war, and we don't want this, and we don't want that, right? And they were the anti-establishment. And I think what you're seeing in these new generations is they're saying the same thing. It's not quite exactly an equal example, but every generation in context to its previous cohort is doing a comparison.
Mm-hmm.
I think as we evolve, we just get more and more clear on what we want and what we don't want, what we're going to stand for and what we're not going to stand for. And I believe in 100 years that what we're talking about, and I really hope this is true, that this distinction will be so clear, and that the companies that do it, that get it now and start evolving this mindset and this paradigm and shifting it, will be in existence. And those that don't, won't.
I love that. Well, here's to that clarity. And here's to you joining me today. Thank you so much, Natalie. This has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. It's so much fun to talk to people like you that are so clear and so insightful.
Well, you're the one bringing the insights today, and that's why you're on the show. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Next in Queue is brought to you by Happy 2 and is produced by me, Rob Dwyer. If you enjoy this podcast, please, by all means, subscribe and or rate this podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. But more importantly, please tell just one person about this podcast. Word of mouth is the best way for people to discover new content. As always, thanks for listening.